On this week's anthology.
They fluster about and flutter their hands, and I can see a clash of civilizations brewing in the Sears bathroom.
The story goes something like this. Every morning when I wake up and look at my closet, I ask myself, how much do I want to be street harassed today?
Do you have your bathroom ID? An anthology of fiction and poetry about the surprising ways that toilets and toilettes define us.
Discover.
Imagine.
Relate.
Engage.
Escape.
In this episode, a poem by Moja Kaf about the meeting of Muslim and Midwestern customs in a public restroom. A satire by Jonathan Swift. Writings by the transgender artist Alok Vadmenon, and more. The Cricket's Bone Caravan starts its one-room tour now.
The watch cycle will start in 5 seconds. Please walk to Quebec.
My grandmother puts her feet in the sink of the bathroom at Sears to wash them in the ritual washing for prayer, wudu, because she has to pray in the store or miss the mandatory prayer time for Muslims. She does it with great poise, balancing herself with one plump, matronly arm against the automated hot air hand dryer after having removed her support knee-highs and laid them aside, folded in thirds, and given me her purse and her packages to hold so she can accomplish this August ritual and get back to the ritual of shopping for housewares. Respectable Sears matrons shake their heads and frown as they notice what my grandmother is doing. An affront to American porcelain. Contamination of American standards by something foreign and unhygienic, requiring civic action and possible use of disinfectant spray. They fluster about and flutter their hands, and I can see a clash of civilizations brewing in the Sears bathroom. My grandmother, though she speaks no English, catches their meaning, and her look in the mirror says, I have washed my feet over Iznik tile in Istanbul, with water from the world's ancient irrigation systems. I have washed my feet in the bathhouses of Damascus over painted bowls imported from China, among the best families of Aleppo. And if you Americans knew anything about civilization and cleanliness, you'd make wider wash bins anyway. My grandmother knows one culture, the right one. As do these matrons of the Middle West. For them, my grandmother might as well have been squatting in the mud over a rusty tin in vaguely tropical squalor, Mexican or Middle Eastern, it doesn't matter which, when she lifts her well-groomed foot and puts it over the edge. You can't do that, one of the women protests, turning to me. Tell her she can't do that. We wash our feet 5 times a day, my grandmother declares hotly in Arabic. My feet are cleaner than their sink. Worried about their sink, are they? I should worry about my feet. My grandmother nudges me. Go on, tell them. Standing between the door and the mirror, I can see, at multiple angles, my grandmother and the other shoppers, all of them decent and good-hearted women, diligent in cleanliness, grooming, and decorum. Even now my grandmother, not to be rushed, is delicately drying her pumps with tissues from her purse, for my grandmother always wears well-turned pumps that match her purse. I think in case someone from one of the best families in Aleppo should run into her. Here, in front of the Kenmore display. I smile at the Midwestern women as if my grandmother has just said something lovely about them, and shrug at my grandmother as if they had just apologized through me. No one is fooled, but I hold the door open for everyone and we all emerge on the sales floor and lose ourselves in the great common ground of housewares on markdown.
Poet, novelist, and essayist Moja Kaf was born in Damascus in 1967. Before she turned 4, her family left Syria because of political differences with the regime. They moved to the U.S. but maintained a devout household. Her novel, The Girl in the Tangerine Scarf, is set in Indiana, where she lived for several years as a girl. The poem, My Grandmother Washes Her Feet in the Sink of the Bathroom at Sears, comes from Emails from Scheherazade, published in 2003 by University Press of Florida. The book situates the legendary storyteller in the 21st century. In a 2008 guest column for the Washington Post, Koff wrote that, "It irks me that I even have to say this. Being a Muslim woman is a joyful thing. My first neighbor in Arkansas borrowed my Quran and returned it, saying, 'I'm glad I'm not a Muslim woman.' Excuse me, but a woman with St. Paul in her religious heritage has no place feeling superior to a Muslim woman." Koff is also known as the author of an online sex column drawing on Islam's historical openness to sexual expression, a tradition often overlooked at a time when fundamentalists dominate the news. Her poem, Hijab Scene No. 2, is a curt satire of differences over women's clothing. Here it is in its entirety.
"You people have such restrictive dress for women," she said, hobbling away in 3-inch heels and pantyhose to finish out another pink-collar temp pool day.
You're traveling with the Cricket's Bone Caravan.
In the yard, dewy and shivering, with crickets, we lie naked, face up, face down. I teach her Chinese. Crickets, chill, chill.
This week's anthology asks, do you have your bathroom ID? The following story doesn't take place in a bathroom. And that's the whole point. Zhang Zhixu is a Chinese writer known for flash fiction. Translated by Julie Chu, the story was anthologized in Loud Sparrows, Contemporary Chinese Short Shorts, from Columbia University Press in 2006.
I started off as a good boy, but turned bad as time went by. That was because I didn't used to wet my bed, but later on I did. I changed because of my younger brother. He had wet his bed right from the beginning, and if he made it through one night without wetting the bed, Mom would reward him with a hot chestnut or buy him some candy balls. I could only watch with my mouth watering. I wondered what I could do to get a bite of all this good stuff. Finally, I figured it out. I would wet the bed too. Yet from not wetting the bed to wetting the bed, there was a process. The first time I did it, I got a spanking from Mom. She grabbed a feather duster and beat me with a knobby handle. With every hit on my backside, she said, "You never wet your bed before. Now the older you get, the more childish you become, huh?" I held my tongue, gazing at my mattress, with a spot even bigger and more badly soaked than my brother could have created. The next day, I did the same and got spanked again. As I received my spanking, I thought, I guess if I don't suffer some physical pain, I won't get the treat. The third day, I didn't wet the bed, and I got the same reward that my younger brother always got. As Mom handed me a hot chestnut, she scolded me with a laugh. "Shame on you." But still, we call that progress. As I munched on the hot chestnut, I couldn't help touching my recently spanked behind. From then on, I wet the bed every 3 or 4 days and continued to get Mom's little treats. After I grew up, I started off as a good worker, but eventually changed. In the beginning, I took every task seriously and never cut corners. I was the most outstanding worker among my colleagues. But when it came to pay raise or promotion, it was always somebody else who got recommended. Eventually, I wised up. Inspired by my wet-the-bed experience as a child, I started wetting the bed at work. The outcome was surprisingly similar to what I'd experienced in my childhood. I not only got promoted, but also had my salary increase. One year, I even attended the Municipal Confederation of Model Workers, a big red flower on my breast. I took a seat on the rostrum and shared my experience. Imagine how my heart flew. Now, I'm approaching the age of retirement. Whenever I stop and look back, my heart is filled with emotions and laments. Sometimes I tell the story to my son. and it always ends up with his teasing me. At that, I always say, "Don't you laugh at me now. The day you understand your old man's story, you can call yourself fully grown." My son's response? "I hope your story will be outdated soon, or there'll never be progress." Yeah, well, I hope before my story gets outdated, you'll smarten up. My son casts a scornful look at me and turns back to his business. He goes tap, tap, tap on his computer keyboard, sending foreign words I don't recognize up onto that screen.
Although it is night, I sit in the bathroom waiting. Sweat prickles behind my knees. The baby breasts are alert. Venetian blinds slice up the moon. The tiles quiver in pale strips. Then they come, the three seal men with eyes as round as dinner plates and eyelashes like sharpened tines. They bring the scent of licorice. One sits in the washbowl, one on the bathtub edge. One leans against the door. "Can you feel it yet?" they whisper. I don't know what to say. Again. They chuckle, patting their sleek bodies with their hands. Well, maybe next time. And they rise, glittering like pools of ink under moonlight, and vanish. I clutch at the ragged holes they leave behind, here at the edge of darkness. Night rests like a ball of fur on my tongue.
That was Rita Dove's Adolescence 2 from Yellow House on the Corner, published by Carnegie Mellon University Press in 1989, where the bathroom is a site for an anxious rite of passage. More bathroom issues.
トイレはどこですか?
After this. Anthology continues, but first, every road trip needs a bathroom break.
Gas station restroom. The present tense is the body's past tense here. Hence, the ghost sludge of hands on the now gray strip of towel hanging limp from the jammed dispenser. Hence, the mirror squinting through grime at grime, and the worn to a sliver of soiled soap on the soiled sink. The streaked bowl, the sticky toilet seat, air claustral with stink, all residues and traces of the ancestral spirit of body free of spirit. Hence, behind the station, at the back end of the store, hidden away and dimly lit, this cramped and solitary carnival inversion, Paul becoming Saul, becoming sense synonymous, an animal. Hence, over the insides of the lockless stall, the cave-like scribblings and glyphs, declaring unto all who come to it in time, heaven is here at hand, and dark, and hell is odorless. Hell is bright and clean.
Gas Station Restroom by Alan R. Shapiro first appeared in the September 2008 issue of Poetry magazine. Shapiro was first inspired to write poetry by song lyrics in the 1960s. His work often explores his Jewish-American upbringing, and his book Tantalus in Love at one point engages in dialogue with Milton and Paradise Lost, perhaps echoed in this bathroom poem's ending. Here Shapiro reverses a moment from Judeo-Christian narrative, with the Christian apostle Paul reverting to his Jewish identity Saul, Paul becoming Saul opening up the bodily conversion the restroom accommodates as a complex allegory. Ta Huai Chi is a professor of Taiwanese literature who teaches queer theory and disability studies at National Cheng Chi University, Taipei. He earned his doctorate in comparative literature at UCLA. His stories have been translated into English, Japanese, French, and Swedish. A Fawn's Afternoon, translated by Dave Hasem, appeared in the 6th annual queer issue of Words Without Borders in June 2015. It begins at a spa-like hot spring for bathing, an idyllic site that encourages self-exposure. But, as in the Western classical myth of Narcissus, Confronting the truth can destroy those unwilling to accept who they are. Jack Honick reads A Fawn's Afternoon.
The hand of the pocket watch winds on with a sound like mocking laughter, continuously pricking his anxiety, preventing him from forgetting how the nightmare started. He remembers. This is how it began. That day of the winter holiday happened to be Asa's birthday. The bus passed through the deep gloom of the bamboo forest, delivering him, in a daze, to the spa town. The lattice of bamboo shadows fell upon him like a glitter of whirling blades, dicing his body to bits. He did, in fact, come to the countryside bearing scars. He could not bring himself to think about the farce of city life any further. He had not hired a scooter, nor booked a hotel room. After passing through a field, Asa arrived at the town's hot spring. The bathing area, encircled by concrete walls, was divided along the middle by the stream of water from the hot spring. Within the mist were the silhouettes of naked male bodies, either soaking in the water or perched on one of the banks. Asa stripped and settled into a state of contemplation amid the fog of shapes. But all of a sudden he saw himself sitting on the opposite side of the stream. Was this a mirror? He extended a tentative hand, and the doppelganger opposite stretched out an arm in symmetrical greeting, bestowing a floating smile through the mist. Asa started in surprise. It was only then that he realized this was some kind of joke. It was the smile that broke the illusion. In fact, it was another bather on the opposite bank, of a similar figure and age, and it was only his deliberate mimicking of Asa's actions that made the trick work. Asa didn't know how he ought to respond. He couldn't just go on staring, in any case, so he lowered his head and continued bathing. When he got up, Asa went by himself to stand at the derelict bus stop, planning to move on to the next stop on his itinerary. Why move on? Asa himself couldn't tell you the reason. The entire trip had been prepared in advance while he was still in the city, and the numerous flaws in the plan were only making themselves apparent now he had arrived. And so when a scooter materialized in front of him, Asa was caught off guard. It was the doppelganger who had been sitting on the opposite bank just before. Waiting for the bus, asked the rider, the smile of a 20-year-old still on his face. It seemed like he was attempting to make up for his tomfoolery back in the spa. You'll be waiting forever. The bus doesn't come down here. Trust me, I'm a local. Where are you going? Why don't you let me give you a ride? Asa couldn't exactly say where he was going, so the only thing he could do was get on the scooter and go wherever this guy ended up taking him. What's your name? Asa. You can call me Kay. Yes, I'm into Kafka. How about you? Where do you want to go, anyway? If we carry on circling around like this much longer, we'll end up back at the spa. If you don't have anywhere in particular to go, why don't we sit by the field and chat for a while? It's not like this town has anywhere particularly worth visiting, anyway. Kay climbed up the bank beside the field, pulled out a harmonica, and played an idle tune, like a kind of pastoral ode. He said it was Debussy's Prelude to a Fawn's Afternoon. It was an apt melody to play out here in the wilderness, said Kay. Though the season may have been loneliest winter, his hand held only the harmonica, and not a fawn's pipe. You really look like someone from the city, Kay. Are you really a local? Really, this is my hometown, but just like all the other kids in Taiwan, I can't help heading to the city for an occasional week-long spree, coming back to the sticks only to sink into the springs once I'm spent. And now I've had my soak, the next part of a fawn's afternoon is a dance. Do you dance? A fawn's afternoon should be accompanied by a dance. Have you heard Nijinsky? I'll show you. I was taught this dance by a senior classmate who adored me. Kay laid down his harmonica and began to dance in the field. It seemed as though the melody he'd been playing lingered in the air, wrapping itself around his body. To Asa, watching from the side of the field, Kay looked like a writhing snake. After a while, he pulled out a banknote on which to sketch this winter fawn. Have you studied drawing? Kay danced over to Asa's side. I was planning on majoring in fine arts, and my test scores on the entrance exams weren't good enough to get in. But then my family wouldn't let me. They just wouldn't. All I could do was take it on the chin and start taking cram classes in the city to get ready to apply for a major with better prospects. Drawing is never going to be more than a pastime. I don't know which of us is the lucky one. You wanted to study fine art, but couldn't. I love to dance, and I didn't get into a dance academy. But you still have the freedom to draw, whereas I can't dance properly. I fractured my arm, so I was still holding myself back when I was dancing just now. My friend and I got into a bike accident in the autumn. I broke my arm, so I couldn't take part in dance classes anymore, which meant I had to drop out. My injury meant I could avoid conscription, so I just came home to recover and recuperate in the hot springs. And your friend? My classmate? He died. The person in this sketch is you. Here, take it. Perfect. Today is my birthday, as it happens. I thought I'd have to spend the day all on my own, but now here I am, getting a birthday present. Also stayed at Kay's home that night. It was the kind of detached three-story building common to the countryside, several fields away from its nearest neighbor. The fact that Kay was the only person living there made it feel even more gloomy and empty. Having brought food and drinks back with them, they chatted into the night, but also didn't have much of a stomach for alcohol, and was soon tired. In the midst of his dreams, he felt a strange sensation, as though there were a hand reaching into his underwear, running up and down his body, unrestrained. In the muddle of sleep, it felt like a snake winding around his whole body, inescapable. This snake was not cold, but hot. But that was the frightening thing about it. And so, when he woke in the morning with a bleary head, he couldn't quite bring himself to believe that the snake had been nothing more than the woolen blanket that was now on top of him. I tried to put you to bed last night, but I couldn't get you to wake up. So all I could do was throw this blanket over you. Over breakfast, Kay produced a picture frame, in which he had encased Osso's sketch. I threw away my family photo and put your sketch inside instead. They've all moved away, anyhow. I'll hang it up in a bit, and I have something to give you. Don't turn it down, and don't take offense, okay? It was a pocket watch. There were slight ridges on the surface of the lid, like on the smooth back of a young man. On the reverse side of the lid was an inlaid engraving of the half-human, half-bestial form of a miniature fawn. Kay said he was giving it to Osso because he believed him capable of taking good care of it. It wasn't the kind of present that could be given away on a whim. This was Kay's second pulsating heart. It had been a present to Kay from the classmate who had passed away, who had seen Kay on his fawn's afternoon. Kay didn't want to look upon this memory-burdened watch anymore, but nor could he bring himself to throw it away. So he was passing it on to Osso, and Kay hoped that this watch would become a part of his life, like a seal of friendship, inerasable. But neither of them had anticipated what would happen that day, the day of Osso's departure. Kay handed the hammer to Osso and asked him to stand up on the chair and bang the nail into the wall, so that they could hang up the sketch. Kay's hand was supporting Osso's leg, and he was again telling the story of what had happened in the autumn, when all of a sudden Osso yelled, "Don't touch me! Don't touch me! There's nothing I hate more than people touching me." Osso hadn't realized he could be so jumpy. Could he still be hungover? And he couldn't even be sure what he had just shouted. And there was no way of confirming with Kay, who was standing behind him, because somehow there was now a hammer sticking out of the middle of his forehead. The hammer that had been in Osso's hand. Uttering nothing more than a faint murmur, Kay slumped to the floor, blood seeping from his head. Osso calmed himself down. He carefully packed away the hammer, sketch, and pocket watch, and took them away. Kay had not made much noise when he fell to the floor. There had been no one else around in the immediate vicinity. Kay had approached the stall to buy their dinner of stewed dishes on his own. No one had noticed Osso. Kay's family had all moved away. No one would be visiting this house for a while. Osso used the blanket to carefully wrap Kay, rolling him up like a snake before stuffing the bundle into a closet. Kay aside, there was no one who would remember Osso coming to this spa town. I need to get back to Taipei. None of this ever happened. I just drank too much, that's all. I still have an entrance exam to take. There's nothing I hate more than people putting their hands all over me. I barely knew him. Who knows who he was? On his way out of town, the general store, where Also was buying a Coke, happened to be playing a cover version of an old song. Also began to pay attention to the regional news in all the big newspapers, but after several days, there had still been no mention of the name of the spa town, let alone the incident involving Kay. Perhaps the whole thing had been some kind of dream brought on by the drink. Once Also was back in Taipei, the distant spa town seemed almost insubstantial, non-existent, and yet he was unable to forget it all completely. The pocket watch, the sketch, the hammer. These cursed keepsakes were now stored under Also's bed in the small apartment room he was renting for the sake of the exam. But Also could not put the pocket watch from his mind. He couldn't help taking it out and holding it to his chest, because, somehow, he belonged to the watch now. He was a morsel for its delectation. Since leaving Kay's house, the pocket watch had become Also's second heart, a heart that had come from Kay. The ticking of its hands seemed to echo the rhythm of his heartbeat, synchronized. He found that he was only able to sleep at night if he could hear the resonance between ticking watch and beating heart. He had tried listening to the sound of other timepieces, like clocks, wristwatches, ordinary pocket watches, but it was no good. It was only the pocket watch Kay had given him that could serve as his second heart. And so, whether it was in the impatience of midnight or after suffering until daybreak, he always ended up casting all these other clocks aside and hanging Kay's pocket watch around his neck again so that he could sleep. Truly, he wished he could forget the curse of this watch. Late at night, he would sometimes take a sleeping pill to try and put it out of his mind. No use. An hour later, he would swallow a second, and then a third, a fourth, a fifth. Also worried he might end up taking an overdose, but then again, since he was unable to get a night's rest without the pocket watch, he feared that eternal rest might prove unattainable too. Also was not prepared to go see a psychiatrist, because he did not want to be forced to speak of the thing he most wanted to forget. The pocket watch had possessed him. Or perhaps it was the Fawn. Or Kay. He gave in to the pocket watch, wearing it at his cram classes so that he wouldn't miss out on even the chance for a nap at lunch break. His classmates noticed the watch he bore on his chest, and they saw that his face was getting more sallow and withered by the day. Occasionally, a curious classmate would ask the story of the pocket watch, and try and get him to open up the lid so they could look inside, but also would never let them. Open the lid. Open the lid. This irresistible pocket watch wanted to be opened, so that it could be fully appreciated. But also himself, whose presence the class found increasingly disturbing, was also a tight lid in need of opening. Open the lid. There was no phrase he wanted to hear less, but it was the phrase he kept on hearing. Open the lid. I must become flesh. The Fawn embossed on the watch called Kay from within the closet where he was bundled in a blanket. This voice, together with the ticking of the watch, darted through a hole in Also's heart, burrowing deep, so deep that only Also himself could hear it. Open the lid. The cry inside him spliced with his sleep, his two hearts, one flesh, one metal, completely intertwined. Two hearts together, two bloodstreams flowing together. For Also, the pocket watch had become an organ. For the pocket watch, Also had become a piece of flesh. Open the lid. This was the protestation of the Fawn. Let me out. This was the protestation of Kay. Open the lid. The sound of Also's blood chafing at his veins. All right, I'll let you out. Also could take it no longer. On a Sunday afternoon when spring was approaching, at his wit's end, A bare-chested Asa threw down his reference book in his room. He rolled over and reached under the bed to pull out the hammer, wrapped in old newspaper. And the date on the newspaper was still his birthday, and was still Asa's birthday. Intending to silence this pocket watch for good, his sleek young back was glimmering, slick with sweat. If he really were to smash this watch, this accompanist of his heart, would sleep elude him forever? But Asa didn't care. He had to silence the voices. He tore off the pocket watch and took the hammer from the newspaper. The fawn on the lid was shrieking, in anguish and in ecstasy. At last he gripped the hammer that thirsted for blood and struck the pocket watch. There was a noise of shattering metal. Once, twice, three times. The lid had cracked, but Asa could strike no more. Uttering nothing more than a faint murmur, he slumped to the floor. For Asa, the pocket watch had become an organ. For the pocket watch, Asa had become a piece of flesh. On his smooth young back appeared the same cracks that were on the lid of the watch. It was as though the vertebrae of his spine were a zipper that had been unfastened, disgorging a plasmic torrent. Asa never got the chance to see the creature that emerged, blood-slathered from his back. Half man and half beast. The fawn embossed on the lid of the pocket watch. Corporeal. Whistling, the monster danced in the same steps that Kay had danced in the field, before bursting out of the door and disappearing down the stairs of the apartment building. And the sketch of Kay remained safely stashed under Osso's bed, steeped in the smile of a sunny winter's afternoon in the countryside.
Anthology's tour of Unrestrooms continues. After the break, a satire by Jonathan Swift and poetry by a self-described South Asian non-binary trans femme writer. Break is over.
Do you have your bathroom ID?
Back to Anthology. Gulliver's Travels is one of the best-known fantasy books in all English literature, but its author, Jonathan Swift, was born and died in Ireland. He's also known for A Modest Proposal, arguably the most famous short satire in English. Its full title is A Modest Proposal for Preventing the Children of Poor People in Ireland from Being a Burden to Their Parents or Country, and for Making Them Beneficial to the Public. The solution? Raise infants as a food crop. Swift offers some terribly timely policy. If infants become a delicacy for the wealthy, poor women won't feel compelled to seek out abortions, but instead, at virtually no cost, can suckle their babies for a year and then turn a profit in the market for human veal. And men would be less likely to beat their pregnant wives for fear of harming the valuable fetus. The ironic distance between the author's intention and what the speaker says is also a technique of the verse satire you're about to hear. The ladies' dressing room has often been regarded as one long orgy of misogyny. More perceptive readers have noted that Swift admired independent, intellectual women, and in his later years, preferred women as friends. The attack is on the hapless male Strephon, who's shocked to learn that ladies, under the elaborate maquillage and piled wigs and layers of flounces of 18th-century dress, have bodily functions just as men do. Celia's name means heavenly. Strephon had been a stock character in English lit since his 16th century appearance as a hopelessly romantic shepherd in Sir Philip Sidney's Arcadia. It didn't take long for him to become an object of parody, and it seems obvious that for Swift, Strephon is a vehicle for skewering the cluelessness of the male gaze. Though few of us truly escape the prejudices of our time, and Swift can't have been free of the gender boundaries so strictly policed in his day. Now, we also thought it was hilarious to hear Jonathan Swift, who himself wore a massive curled periwig, employ a common vulgarity for defecate. But don't worry, we bleep it out. Here's The Ladies' Dressing Room by Jonathan Swift.
5 hours, and who can do it less than by haughty Celia spent in dressing? The goddess from her chamber issues, arrayed in lace, brocades, and tissues. Strephon, who found the room was void and Betty otherwise employed, stole in and took a strict survey of all the litter as it lay, whereof, to make the matter clear, an inventory follows here. And first, a dirty smock appeared beneath the armpits well besmeared. Strephon the rogue displayed it wide and turned it round on every side. On such a point few words are best, and Strephon bids us guess the rest. But swears how damnably the men lie in calling Celia sweet and cleanly. Now listen while he next produces the various combs for various uses filled up with dirt so closely fixed no brush could force a way betwixt. A paste of composition rare, sweat, dandruff powder, lead, and hair, a forehead cloth with oil upon it to smooth her wrinkles, on her front here alum flower to stop the steams, exhaled from sour, unsavory streams, their night gloves made of Tripsy's hide, bequeathed by Tripsy when she died, with puppy water, beauty's help, distilled from Tripsy's darling whelp, her galley pots and vials placed, some filled with washes, some with paste, some with pomatum, paints and slops, and ointments good for scabby chops, hard by a filthy basin stands, fouled with the scouring of her hands. The basin takes whatever comes, the scraping of her teeth and gums, a nasty compound of all hues, for here she spits and here she spews, but oh, it turned poor Strephon's bowels when he beheld and smelled the towels, begummed, bematted, and beslined with dirt and sweat and earwax grimed. No object Strephon's eye escapes here, petticoats in frowsy heaps, nor be the handkerchiefs forgot, all varnished o'er with snuff and snot. The stockings, why should I expose, stained with the marks of stinking toes, or greasy coughs and pinners reeking, which Celia slept at least a week in? A pair of tweezers next he found to pluck her brows in arches round, or hairs that sink the forehead low, or on her chin like bristles grow. The virtues we must not let pass of Celia's magnifying glass. When frightened Strephon cast his eye on it, it showed visage of a giant, a glass that can to sight disclose the smallest worm in Celia's nose, and faithfully direct her nail to squeeze it out from head to tail. For catch it nicely by the head, it must come out alive or dead. As mutton cutlets prime of meat, which though with art you salt and beat, as laws of cookery require, and toast them at the clearest fire, if from a down the hopeful chops the fat upon a cinder drops, to stinking smoke it turns a flame, poisoning the flesh from whence it came, and up exhales a greasy stench, from which you curse the careless wench. So things which must not be expressed, when plumped into the reeking chest, send up an excremental smell to taint the parts from whence they fell, the petticoats and gown perfume which waft a stink round every room. Thus finishing his grand survey, disgusted Strephon stole away, repeating in his amorous fits, "O Celia, 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 shoot this!" But vengeance, goddess never sleeping, soon punished Strephon for his peeping. His foul imagination links each dame he sees with all her stinks. And if unsavory odors fly, conceives a lady standing by, all women his description fits, and both ideas jump like wits. But vicious fancy coupled fast, and still appearing in contrast, I pity wretched Strephon blind to all the charms of female kind. Should I the queen of love refuse because she rose from stinking ooze? To him that looks behind the scene, satyra's but some pocky queen. When Celia in her glory shows, if Strephon would but stop his nose, who now so impiously blasphemes her ointments, daubs, and paints, and creams, her washes, slops, and every clout with which he makes so foul a rout, he soon would learn to think like me, and bless his ravished sight to see such order from confusion sprung, such gaudy tulips raised from dung.
The story goes something like this. Every morning when I wake up and look at my closet, I ask myself, how much do I want to be street harassed today? This means I usually gravitate away from the skirts and dresses and move begrudgingly toward the more conventionally masculine clothing. I consider for a moment how peculiar it feels that I've been made to find safety and security in masculinity, this thing that has been such a site of violence and anxiety in my past. This weekend, I did the same. I woke up. I looked in the closet and I saw this new dress I got on sale. But after I put it on, I knew that I would have to pay for it anyways. At my performance downtown in the evening, everyone told me that they loved this dress and remarked on how fabulous I looked. I did not mention the stares, the slurs, the panic, the terror. I smiled, said, "Thank you." After the show, I was walking home with one of my trans sisters, and a man rolled down his window and screamed, "What the f*** are you f***ing wearing?" There is something particularly unsettling about being harassed right outside of your home. Like that one time on my way home, this man screamed, "You better take off that dress or else!" And I walked faster and faster and didn't look back while his girlfriend laughed at me. I will never forget her laugh. It left a stain on that dress, stubborn and permanent like wine. I remember that for so many of us, home is not that sacred place away from violence. It is actually that place constituted by violence, a type of violence that holds the paradox of being both perpetual and surprising, keeps you on your toes. That night, I started thinking about how so many femmes I know are literally attacked for loving ourselves. How so many of us are harassed most on the days we think we look best. How dangerous and lethal self-love can be. I started thinking about how so many narratives in our culture are obsessed with authenticity. How we as trans people are celebrated because we have embraced our truth. And I think about what this does, how it standardizes visibility as authenticity, how it understands authenticity outside of violence, how it erases all of the calculations we must make to keep ourselves safe and whole. Can we hold that on days we are most authentic, that we are most ourselves, that we love ourselves the most, are the days that we are most terrified and afraid? Can we hold that not everyone can nor should afford to be authentic, because it means that they will be turned away from gender-segregated bathrooms, shelters, parties, lovers? Can we challenge the hierarchy that's drawn between those who are out and authentic and those who are not, as if these distinctions don't have everything to do about race, class, security, home, terror, history? Can we be more critical of a culture that tells us that we are brave for being ourselves instead of dismantling the structures that made that so impossible to begin with? I wonder whether we are ready to be more compassionate and appreciative for the ways that we have come to disguise ourselves. Can we find resistance in our duplicity and our disingenuousness? Can we remember the ways in which being inauthentic has kept us alive? Today, I woke up and looked at my closet, and I remembered the street outside and that man and his girlfriend's laughter. So I put on a button-down shirt and a beard and some pants, and I have never felt more like a woman in my entire life.
That was Lying by Alok Vadmenon. Vadmenon self-describes as a South Asian non-binary trans femme who's a performance artist and community organizer. They prefer a plural pronoun. Now based in New York City, they grew up in Texas. In an essay earlier this year, Vadmenon wrote,
"Gender policing is part of a bigger strategy of establishing who is beautiful, who is desirable, who is worthy, who is allowed to be seen, and conversely, who must be disappeared, who must be made forbidden. Trans and GNC people aren't being shut out because we are undesirable, but precisely because we are desirable. So desirable, in fact, that they have to erect hundreds of bills and statutes to keep us private, to regulate our mobility, to keep us at bay. So desirable that they are uncomfortable sharing space with us, peeing next to us, even washing their hands next to us. So desirable that they cannot seem to stop obsessing about our genitalia, our bodies, our fashion,
We close today with Alok Vadmenon's poem, Transmisogyny, which appeared in the first issue of Vetch, a magazine of trans poetry and poetics, in the fall of 2015.
Promise me that I will matter if I don't shave. Promise me that I will matter if I don't wear a dress. Promise me that I will matter if I don't wear makeup. Promise me that I will matter if I am not fabulous. Promise me that I will matter if I'm not visible. Promise me that I will matter if I am ugly. Promise me that I will matter if I'm not articulate. Promise me that I don't have to have been born this way. Promise me that I don't have to always have known. Promise that I don't have to modify my body to matter. Promise me that you will not assume what it was like for me to grow up. Promise me that you will not repost all of the articles about how we shouldn't assume gender and then still do it. Promise me that you won't call me by my pronouns and then treat me by my body. Promise me that I don't have to perform white femininity to matter. Promise me that I don't have to perform cis femininity to matter. Promise me that I don't have to perform upper class femininity to matter. Promise me that you see the femme in my hairy body. Promise that you see the femme in my brown body. Promise that you see the femme in my messy, uncouth, dirty, scarred body. Promise that you understand that my gender is not just a hobby or a politic. Promise me that you understand that I wasn't just assigned male at birth. I am assigned male every day I walk outside the house. Promise me this is a form of street harassment. Promise me this is a form of gender violence. Promise me that you'll say something when they call me he. Promise me that you understand that I am hurt. Promise me that you understand that I am scared. Promise me that you understand that sometimes I prioritize my safety over your binary. Promise me that you will allow me to narrate the story of my body. Promise me that you won't love me like a man, kiss me like a man, f*** me like a man. Promise me you won't forget that when you bring me home. Promise me you won't forget that when you tell your friends about me. Promise me you won't forget that when you're horny. Promise me that they will not look back on my life and call this a phase. Promise me that you believe me when I tell you this is not a phase. Promise that I will matter when I am too tired to prove my gender to you. Or don't. I'm used to it.
You've been listening to Do You Have Your Bathroom ID? On Anthology. You heard these voices from the Cricket's Bone Caravan.
Tony Brewer.
Frank Buzelich.
Berkeley Going.
Patsy Ron.
Michael Perry.
Renee Reed.
Jack Honick read A Fawn's Afternoon.
Did you recognize this week's cricket quote?
In the yard, dewy and shivering with crickets.
Tweet us at cricketsbone if you know the source, or email us at looselit, one word, lowercase, at gmail.com. Anthology is produced, written, and edited by Cynthia Wolfe. Our theme music is Kong by Ciro Baptista from his album Blue Fly, released in 2016 by Zadik. To learn more about the music in this week's episode, or to listen to previous episodes, visit indianapublicmedia.org/anthology. And join us next time for Utopians, poetry and short fiction from East Asia, Syria, and the World War I era United States, on the costs of longing for a better society. For Anthology, this is Heather Perry. Keep listening to the voices outside your head.